So it's great to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation. I was reminded as I came in with the breakfast out there of a chance encounter that I had a couple of years ago. I was in Geneva with a bunch of graduate students. We were at the ICRC headquarters, Red Cross headquarters, and I ran into the former Israeli ambassador. And he said, "So Daniel, I'm sure you know the story about your name in the Bible, Daniel in the lion's den." So, yeah, heard that when I was a kid in Bible school. He said, "But I bet you don't know the real story about why the lions didn't eat Daniel." And I said, "No, I'll bite, so to speak." But I'm sorry, it'll get better. He said, "Well, what happened was the king put Daniel in the lion's den, and he's watching because he's waiting for the lions to devour Daniel. And they're creeping up on him closer and closer and closer. And then Daniel leaned down and whispered something to the lions, and they got this panicked look and ran away. And so the king called Daniel up and he said, I'm baffled by this. Everything was going according to plan. They were creeping up. They were going to have you for breakfast. And then they looked panicked and ran away. What did you say to them?" He said, "Oh, I just said, well, after the meal, there will be speeches." So after your breakfast, I'll try not to make this too painful. excuse me. Even though I'm a displaced Mississippian filtered through Louisiana and Pittsburgh and now Washington, D.C., I feel kind of like an honorary Texan, at least, because I've been associated with the dispute resolution program at Southern Methodist University for about a decade now, and I actually even had an apartment in Plano for a while, so I feel like an honorary Texan, so I really appreciate the invitation to be here. The topic that Jennifer asked me to talk about is one that I've been talking about for a long time, and that is the influence of technology on the practice, not only of mediation, but of all types of conflict engagement, mediation, facilitation, dialogue, peace building, all of it, access to justice, everything. And excuse me, what I'd like to do this morning is talk a little bit about definitions and how our perceptions of the use of technology in mediation have been colored by the definitions that we use. Talk a little bit about some of the uses of technology that are becoming more and more common, and then talk a little bit about what I see as some of the changes that may be coming that are more revolutionary than evolutionary. The topic this morning that was given was evolution, not revolution. And so let me start with the term itself. We tend to have thought about online dispute resolution, ODR, and ADR as polar opposites. If you've been around technology and dispute resolution at all, you've heard the term ODR, online dispute resolution. And the tendency has been to think that it's over here and ADR practice is over here. There's even in the most recent edition of the International Journal of Online Dispute Resolution, there's a point-counterpoint by Colin Rule and Carrie Minkle-Meadow. And the title of the point-counterpoint is ODR ADR? I'm going to suggest that that's not the most constructive way to look at the notion of technology and dispute resolution. In fact, I would rather think about it as an evolutionary process. That's me on the far right. Excuse me. Now, I say it's evolutionary, not revolutionary, because of the notion of what revolution is. Those of us who have been dealing with technology and dispute resolution are not a crowd with pitchforks. We're not coming to take over the practice and boot you out and bring in automated mediators. In fact, revolution suggests thorough replacement, upending systems. And I think if you look at what's happened with dispute resolution and technology, it's much more evolutionary than revolutionary. About a year or so ago, I was talking with a graduate student at a place where I teach. I won't name the place. And she was saying that she had given a ride from the airport to a professor, a very well-known mediator, who was coming to the university to do a presentation. And that in the drive from the airport to the university, she had mentioned that she was taking my online dispute resolution course. And his immediate response was, "Well, that'll never work." Now, his topic at his conference was handling parties with intractable positions. And I suggested that it was probably going to be a really good workshop, because he obviously had some association with the topic. It's always seemed to me that ICT and technology and ADR were a natural fit. The first time I was ever personally involved in using technology to do mediation was back in the mid-1980s, when I put together a mediation between North Africa, the UK, and Washington, D.C., using telephones and fax machines. And it occurred to me at the time that there might be something to this, that we might be headed in a direction where some of the tools that we were going to have at our disposal would be adaptable to mediation practice. This has not always been a mainstream opinion. The "it'll never work" attitude has been moderating somewhat. I have often felt like somebody in the wilderness. It's changing a lot. Just last week, I saw the International Mediation Institute's new certification standards for technology and dispute resolution. And I'm chairing a workshop, or a working group, rather, of the ABA, the ACR, and the AAA to revisit the models, rules, and standards that have been in place since 2005. And one of the reasons we're doing that, not the only reason, but one of the reasons we're doing that is it seems to us that technology has wormed its way into our practice in ways that we need to pay attention to. So if I'm right about the fact that technology is worming its way into our practice, what's changed? The extent to which we are using technology in our practice, I think, mirrors exactly the extent to which we are allowing technology into our lives. Excuse me. I think we're living through a time where the communication and information changes that are being wrought by online technology are at least as significant as those that were wrought by the invention of the printing press. And you just have to look at some of the statistics to figure this out. In 2005, when the current standards, the model rules, were developed, 5% of Americans were using social media. In 2017, it'll hit 70% are using social media. 21% of Americans say that they're on the internet almost constantly. This is Pew Research information. So basically what we're doing is we're communicating with more people in more ways, using more channels than we ever have in our daily lives. And I don't see how that can help spilling over into our profession. Probably the most startling statistic to me is that 1 in 3 marriages now are between people who met online. And you throw into this mix the use of mobile telephony. In February 2014, for the first time, more people hit the internet in the U.S. using mobile phones and mobile devices than use desktop computers. And so we're carrying it around with us all the time. It's part of our lives. And as I have said in other venues, if our parties can buy a house online, if they can get psychological help online, if they can find someone to marry online, if they can do all those things online, they're going to want to know, why can't I deal with you online? They're going to be asking that question. So your parties are going to push you to use technology. And frankly, what I have found in the work that we've done is that when we find a way to integrate technology into the work we do, it isn't the parties who push back. The parties get it right away because it's convenient for them. It offers something to them. It's the practitioners who push back. It's the people who are the practitioners who don't want to change. The parties will push you to do it, I'm quite sure. One of the problems that we have when we talk about ODR is that we're stuck with a legacy definition and some legacy impressions. So I'll talk about those just for a moment. ODR comes out of a time in the mid-1990s that follows what I think is the most significant dispute resolution decision made in the last 50 years. In 1992, the National Science Foundation opened up the internet to commercial activity. Prior to that, the internet had been sort of a private club with academics and government folks who were operating with a limited number of nodes in a trusted community, and it was essentially a research and communication tool for a specific set of organizations. In 1992, the NSF, which was funding the development of the internet, said, well, we're going to open it up to commercial use. The very first group, just as a side note, was Pizza Hut. In 1993, if you were living near a Pizza Hut that was involved in their experiment, you could order your pizza online. And you had to go pick it up, but you could order it online. Much more significant than that is the poster child for online dispute resolution, which is eBay. eBay was founded in 1995, and by the end of that decade, by the end of the 1990s, if the members of eBay had been a country and they had been citizens, it would have been the third largest country in the world. And that number is paltry compared to the number of people who are using online commerce now. It has absolutely exploded. And excuse me, in the mid-90s and toward the late 90s, Ethan Cash and Janet Rifkin and a couple of others made a fundamental observation that I think is, again, one of the most significant things that's happened in dispute resolution in quite a long time. They realized that in e-commerce, we were creating disputes that were unlike disputes that we create in a face-to-face environment. That we created them online to a very large degree. The people who were online couldn't get together even if they wanted to. If you have a buyer in Scotland and a seller in Iowa, there is no place, physical place, that they can get together. The only way, and it crosses all boundaries, it crosses legal venues, it does all sorts of things that mess up our notion traditionally of online of dispute resolution. So the only way to handle that is to create systems in the environment that created the conflict. And as Ethan once said, if you think the internet has the capacity to help us resolve conflict, it will be dwarfed by the ability of the internet to create conflict. And he was right. So we're talking not just different kinds of conflict, but we're talking massive amounts of conflict. So just taking today's figures, eBay handles every year around 60 million disputes. And they're not by any means the largest anymore. And if you have 60 million disputes coming in the front door, you simply cannot hire enough blood and bone and flesh mediators to handle that that volume. And so what you have to do is you have to create systems that stand in place of human mediators. And so what they've done over the years is they've created what I've called a funnel system. They operate in a bounded universe. There are only so many things that can go wrong in e-commerce, and there are only so many things you can do about it when they go wrong in e-commerce. So you can pretty well develop algorithms and decision trees and other kinds of artificially intelligence-aided systems that will help you take care of those conflicts. And so with eBay, for example, that 60 million figure coming in the front door, only 10% of that ever goes to a human mediator. All the rest of it is taken care of by offering information, which is what many people who have a conflict want, just some information about what they can do, or by simple decision trees and algorithms that lead you through a series of steps that offer some types of resolution that you might be able to take advantage of. Now, the upshot of all that is that when we think about ODR traditionally, we've tended to think about it as this cradle-to-grave system that takes away business from mediators and stands in place of mediators. So we have that sort of mindset about what ODR is. And I want to change that definition significantly if I can. ODR is not the wholesale replacement of human mediators by technology. ODR is, in my mind, simply the intelligent application of technology, ICT, information and communication technology, to any dispute resolution or conflict engagement process, be it mediation or anything else. Now, ODR, in the commercial sense, still continues to develop. It's out there, and in fact, it's getting more and more sophisticated, and with IBM's Watson and some of the other IE programs that are going to overtake Watson pretty soon, we're eventually going to see some pretty interesting stuff, and I'm going to come back to that later. But generally what we've done in our practice is not try to find cradle-to-grave solutions. What we've generally done, and I think everybody in this room has probably done it, is we've taken the stuff that is taking over our lives, our mobile phones and our computers, and because they're part of our everyday lives, we've integrated them into our professional practice. So if you're using a mobile phone to contact your parties, you're doing ODR. If you're using email to communicate, you're doing ODR. If you're using a platform that allows you to share documents online, you're doing ODR. It's not that you have to replace the whole process. What we've all done, I think, is selectively take pieces of things that we do, and we've allowed the technology that's out there to help us do them better, or help us do them differently, at least. So it's not about robots. It's about doing, and the reason I say it's evolutionary, not revolutionary, is that we are doing the same thing we always did. We're just doing it using technology to help us. I'll come back to the revolutionary stuff later. Let me give you a couple of examples of of evolutionary applications of technology in my own practice, and you can determine yourself whether or not they resonate with you. And by the way, they gave me an hour and a half to talk. Trust me, I ain't talking for an hour and a half. What I do want to do is get through some of the comments I'm going to make and then open it up for discussion, because I would really like to hear what you all think about this and have a little bit of dialogue. So we'll have a lot of time for Q&A. So what do I mean by evolutionary use? Well, for me, for example, most of us were trained in what's generally called the North American model of mediation. And it goes back to the mid-1980s and Harvard and MIT and Cornell. And we have this model that in various guises has convening and intake and identification of issues and identification of interests, identification of options, pulling the options together into an agreement, and then in some way or another memorializing that agreement. I mean, that's the general flow of what we do most of the time. So for me, for example, in convening, one of the big problems that you have is scheduling. So I use Doodle and a couple of other programs to allow me to schedule asynchronously. I don't have to get on the telephone and use my calendar. I can just put up an online program that says, okay, when you have a chance, go there and tell me when you're available. And we can organize schedules. I use SurveyMonkey, which I'm sure all of you run into. And you're going to notice, by the way, that this is not revolutionary stuff that I'm talking about. These are applications that you run into all the time. For example, I have to get an agreement to mediate signed. And so I use SurveyMonkey. And what I do with SurveyMonkey is I have a survey that gets all of their data, telephone numbers, contact numbers, addresses, who's going to be their counsel if they have counsel, all of that in the survey form. And then the last question in the survey form, embedded in that, is the agreement to mediate that I want them to sign. And if they agree, they will say, yes, I accept it, and I have a time and date stamped agreement to mediate done before we ever get together. If they don't like that, there's a comment box they can get back to me, and we can then start talking about what that agreement needs to do and how I may need to adjust it. But for the most part, I can handle all of my intake and all of my convening online without ever having to get on the telephone and scratch things out of my address book and all that stuff. So is this radical? No, it's not radical. It's the same thing I always did. But I'm using some technology to make it easier for me and the parties to do it. That's an evolutionary use. Storytelling. One of the things that we do a lot of times, that I do, is one of the first things I'll ask the parties is, what brought you here? I mean, what's the issue that we're dealing with? And there's a little storytelling that goes on. They want the ability to say, here's what upset me. Here's why I'm here. There are cases in which I find it's easier and better to do that using a text program that they can send to me that I can look at. And if I want to, call them up and say, you sure you want to share that? Or do you want to do that? You want to say that a little more gently? Or do you really want to pass it along this way? I can be a gatekeeper between the opening comments, so that if the opening comments are inflammatory, I have a chance to actually mediate that. And so I use an online text-based asynchronous format to do the opening storytelling. If not, I very often use a web video platform to do initial meetings, and sometimes to do more than just the initial meetings. So I use WebEx, I use Zoom, I use a couple of others, and there are reasons why I use them. But I'll give you an example of how this can operate. We have one of the mediators from the National Mediation Board, and Jim is sitting over here. One of his colleagues named Mike Tosi was doing a case, I think in Hawaii, if I remember correctly. And it was one of those periods when the funding was uncertain and we couldn't travel. And so he set up a web video session with the parties who were in Hawaii. And they had two caucus rooms, and they had the main room they were in. And they had Mike on a laptop computer. So he had his face on a laptop computer. And so he was actually mediating the case on a laptop. And they started referring to him as Virtual Tosi. When they would go to caucus, they would pick the notebook up, walk it over to the caucus room, set it down, and he would be in the caucus with them. And when he was done with that, they would walk it back over to the other room, he'd be in the caucus with them, then they'd bring him back into the main room and they'd start over again. Now, is that an ideal way to do things? No, but we wouldn't have been able to do that at all had we not adapted that technology to do that. Is it revolutionary? No, we're doing the same thing we always did. We're just using the technology to enable us to do it in a period when face-to-face would have been impossible. Probably the thing that is the most often used by me in my practice is I wanted to find a way to do brainstorming and option generation that would be better than using flip charts, partially because you can't read my writing. And so I started using mind maps. And so there are two that I use a lot. One is called MindMeister, and it's an online program that you can use asynchronously that you can have people go and access whenever they want to use it. But the one I use most often is called FreeMind. And as the name would suggest, it's free. And you can download it onto your computer. And I'll show you a screenshot in just a minute. Maybe that's the next one. Basically, what you can do with a mind map is you can create nodes. And so what I do is I have up here, I've just put some things just for today, just so I have something on the board. But what I will normally do is I'll put our issue statement in the center, and then one of the nodes will be interests. And I'll generate all the interests that the parties have. Now, why is this important to you? What is it we should be paying attention to as we go through this process? I'll have them listed on the mind map. And then I'll have another one that says options. We'll generate all the options that we're going to generate. And underneath each of those, I can add another node that's an explanatory node. And so when I get through with the parties using this mind map technology, what I've got is captured in their own words that they are looking at and affirming to me are accurate as we're doing it in a mind map that gives me the ability to drag things around and put them where they need to be, and so I can point, counterpoint, etc. And all I have to do at the end of our session is hit two buttons. That drops into a Word document with a bullet point list, and that becomes the template on which they write their final agreement. Now, the first time I used this stuff, several years ago, with a parties who were in a fairly complicated negotiation, about 6 months worth of work, and we were meeting about once a week or once every other week over a 6 month period. And we used some document sharing tools and some other things and mind maps a lot. And at the end of the day, we got an agreement. And the parties came up to me and said, look, by using the thing that you used, using those simple tools, you saved us one real day of work a week for 6 months. And for them, that was a very significant thing because time is money for those organizations. And so not only did they not push back, they were like, can we do this again? When you come back and you bring this stuff again. So again, it's not revolutionary. It's the same old stuff that I always did. I'm just using some technology to help me do it better. The other thing that we use a lot, that I wind up using a lot, are single text editing system, joint editing system. So Dropbox or Google Docs or Google Drive, etc. A place where I can put that document that I've created, the bullet list that I've created off of my mind map, I drop that into a joint text editing program. And for the mediations that we do now, most of the time, we have a writing committee. So there's either an attorney or somebody who's on the side whose predominant duty at that point is to put the final language around the agreement. And so they can do that asynchronously. They can do it at any time. They don't have to set up a different session. There's a full tracking mechanism so everybody knows what everybody did. And at the end of the day, we have a document that everybody agrees on that started out with the language they told me was the language they wanted to use as I was making notes that simply got dropped down into a text form. So all of that stuff is an adjunct to my face-to-face work. And all of it is simply doing the things I always did and adapting technology to help me do that. And one of the things that I've said for years is that there are three things that we do over and over again as third parties. We handle communication. We create communication channels and we handle communication among the parties. We help parties understand information. For example, again, in the work that Jim and I do a lot, one of the things is how do you cost things out? How do you know how much something costs? And so one of the things we try to do is create a common costing mechanism. So when we say that we're going to do X, everybody's on the same page about what the expense of that's going to be. All right, so we help people handle information. And the third thing that we do over and over again is we manage group dynamics. And be it at a divorce table with one mediator and two parties, whether it's community mediation where you have multiple parties, we're handling and managing group dynamics. So those are three of the key things that we do as third parties. Well, three of the primary things that ICT does is it gives us massively larger numbers of communication channels, allows us to communicate differently, it gives us lots of different ways to handle information that we never had before, and it helps us even redefine groups. You can have non-proximate groups. So if three of the things that we do as mediators and third parties on a regular basis are three of the core things that ICT offers, how can they not affect each other? They have to affect each other. So there were, in the very beginning, back in the dark ages, there were a couple of attempts to create cradle-to-grave systems. And the two that I'll just point out are Juripax and the Mediation Room. Mediation Room was in the UK, Juripax was in the Netherlands. They came along before people were really ready for it, but they offered basically using the classic mediation model, a platform that you could actually do all the way through online, cradle-to-grave. Currently, Modria is mostly in the e-commerce environment, but still their platform is built on the traditional mediation model. and they can adapt to very many things. And I just the other day was online looking at a product called Brave, which is quite straightforwardly a mediation model, a mediation platform built on this standard mediation model. My point being that even when you have the platforms that are that make it possible for you to do from intake all the way through to agreement online, they're built on the standard model, and you can pick and choose which pieces of them you use. So even with that, with ODR, I'm still not talking about taking over mediation. What I'm talking about is enhancing your ability to do the basic functions that you do as a mediator. That's what I'm interested in. So we're talking about mediation, but it's in other areas as well. For example, in the law, everybody knows about Rocket Lawyer because they advertise all over the place. But you have apps like Ask a Lawyer. Ask a Lawyer is a mobile phone app that allows you to contact an attorney and ask a simple question online from wherever you happen to be. Right? It's not revolutionary, but it sure does change the way you approach potential litigation or potential legal help. My favorite, though, in the law is Oh Crap App. Oh Crap App is a mobile phone app that when you see those blue lights come on behind you on the highway, Oh Crap App gives you advice about what to do and what not to do, and will put you in touch with a local attorney who handles traffic issues. Is that revolutionary? Well, that may be bordering on revolutionary. I don't know. But what it's doing is it's enhancing connections. It's giving you information and enhancing connections. In medicine, you've got See a Doctor Now, and you've got, I don't remember the names of these. They're two mobile apps that basically do the same thing. They basically connect you with medical professionals who are available to give you advice. In psychology, there's PTSD Coach, which again is a mobile app that will give you intervention possibilities. And there's iCouch, which I like a lot, which is basically a counseling program. It's even to the point where Harvard Medical School and Jim Cartwright, bless you, where Jim Cartwright and his group at Harvard Medical are working on online approaches to dealing with depression, and they're very interesting work. But the one that I like the most is that they've actually deployed a dispute resolution system for the space station. And so you have people who are on the space station for an extended period of time in very close quarters with other people, and are there going to be conflicts? As one of my partners said to me one time as we were driving back from a particularly difficult day, as long as there are people, we will have business. So there are people on the space station, they got conflicts. And so what Jim and his partners have put together is a way for them to privately contact someone for advice about how to handle that conflict. Because another thing, you know, obviously this operates in the military, but also in space, where there are a lot of military as well, is to say that I have a problem and seek a third party's assistance is a sign of either weakness or a problem, and it might get you not assigned to the next thing that you want to be assigned to. And so what they've come up with, working in conflict, in concert with all these people, is a way for someone to be able to access help without having to say out loud, I'm accessing help, unless they want to do so. And so this pulls us a little bit closer to what I wish we could call the internet. Back in the early days, there was a guy at MIT, a computer scientist by the name of J.C.R. Licklider. And his nomination for the name of the internet was the Galactic Network. And I wish we had done that. I think it's a lot cooler than the internet. But basically, technology is everywhere. It's even in space. We really can't escape it. Evolutionary IT has some implications, I think, for our rules of practice and our ethics. And we'll talk about those just for a second. There are, as you may know, 9 model rules. And they're not exactly ethical statements, but they actually are ethical statements. And they're closely tied to the ethics of the profession. And I think our technology use, and I bet everybody in this room is using technology in one way or another, either mobile phones or email or something. Every one of those 9 model rules is affected in some way by our use of technology. I want to talk a little bit about 3 of them, but this group that I'm chairing now really is looking at how do we intelligently look at those model rules and either rewrite them or append them in some way. To take into consideration, take into account the fact that we're using technology. So the first one I want to talk about is the need to show competence. The model rule says basically you ought to be competent to deliver the services that you say you're going to deliver. And we have, out of the the hallway there. We've got an accreditation group that's out there. We have mostly 40-hour courses that the Supreme Courts of the States offer that accredit you to take court referred cases. So we have all sorts of ways that we talk about what it means to be competent as a third party, as a mediator. Right now, almost none of those trainings, none of that education really, takes into consideration the impact of technology. And I've always been sort of suspect of the way we measure competency anyway. I was talking a little bit with somebody about this a little while ago. So you say, I've done 5,000 mediations. Well, okay, fine. Did you do them well? or did you do a bad job 5,000 times? Yeah, and not to assume either way, but saying that you did 5,000 mediations doesn't necessarily say anything about how competent you are. And we don't really have very good measures of that. The Bar Association is actually looking at this in a little bit more formalized way than we are. I'm going to read this so I get it right. The Model Rule 1.1 in the ABA basically contains these words. It says, a lawyer shall provide competent representation to a client. Doesn't really say much. But there's a comment that's added to that that adds these words, including the benefits and risks associated with relevant technology. So they've actually added that as part of their notion of what competence is. And the Florida Bar has gone even further than that. They've said that as a lawyer in Florida, you have to take 33 hours of CLE credit over a three-year period. And now 3 hours of that over a three-year period have to be in the use of technology. And so it's now mandatory. And so I think personally that what we're going to have to do as a mediation field, if we don't do exactly that, we're going to have to start thinking about what it means to be competent, what it means to use the technology well. Confidentiality is another area that is touched very strongly by technology use. Confidentiality is a slippery thing anyway. Defining when we are and are not protected by confidentiality rules is not always straightforward. But at least there are some. And we're talking about face-to-face sessions and we're talking about paper, and we probably understand them as well as we can. But when we started using desktop computers to do word processing, and we started saving things on digital technology, on digital devices, we changed the game a bit. Because if I'm doing a face-to-face session and I'm using all paper, at the end, what I was taught and what I teach is you take everything that we did and you shred it, except the agreement to mediate and whatever agreement comes out at the end. Right? And everything else goes away. And when you get as old as I am, if they get you into court and they say, what happened, I can say, I forgot. I don't know. And there's no recourse in that environment. When you save something on a hard drive and then you delete it, it is not gone. If somebody wants it badly enough and they hire a forensics person to come in, they can reconstruct that. So the only way you actually completely get rid of data is you take the hard drive out and you physically destroy it. Now, think about how much we now use cloud services. So now we've got all this stuff bouncing around the internet being saved on servers that we don't have control over. And we may eliminate it at our own desk or on our own phone, and we may even destroy that mechanism, but it may still be out there. And I think one of the more interesting pieces of litigation that we're going to see at some point is some mediator is going to be approached by the court with a discovery order, and the mediator is going to say, well, I'm covered by confidentiality, and they may win that battle. It's not clear whether the cloud server that's holding the data that you erased off of your own system is covered by the same confidentiality. And so one of the things that we need to be thinking about is how do we deal with what are now called the fourth parties? Because we're trusting other groups, other individuals, other corporations to handle the data that we use as a part of our practice, and yet we haven't formalized our relationship with them. If you're a lawyer and you're doing a case and you hire an investigator, that investigator is covered by your own ethics. They're now an extension of you. It's very clear what the relationship is there. Not so in mediation. So that's one of the things that we need to look at. If we've not got revolutionary stuff yet, are we going to get some? And I put the Jetsons up there, looking into the future. And I hesitate to step off into this, frankly, because just about every time I have done this, and just about every time anybody I know has done this, their response later on has been, geez, I wish I hadn't said that in public. Because the future has a way of doing what it's going to do, whether we predict it or not. But having said that, I'll make my leap. I'm going to talk about three things that I think are potentially quite revolutionary. One is what I'm going to call driverless mediation. Now, the development of this is happening in e-commerce because that's where the money is. I mean, we're staggering amounts of money and staggering amounts of research money available. And so what you're having in that environment is artificial intelligence research, natural language research, which is the ability of computers to read and hear spoken language and written language. And so you're moving closer and closer toward automated systems that someday will give you driverless mediation. Right now, it's at about the same stage as driverless cars. We're not quite there yet, but Ford Motor Company and a startup just did a deal that hopefully they think is going to get a production automobile that's driverless on the roads by 2021. And that's not that far away. Right now, what you have is something like you have in my car back home. It's a smart cruise control. Right? So I can get on the highway. I have to go down to Richmond every now and then for these meetings of this Access to Justice Commission that I'm on. And it's about 100 miles, and it's I-95, and it's as boring as driving from Dallas to here yesterday. And this is straight, flat, nothing remarkable. But I can get on the interstate about a half a mile from my house, set my cruise control, and not touch the accelerator or the brake until I get to Richmond. Because what it does is it maintains a distance between all the other cars, it brakes and it accelerates and it does all that stuff. Now, I have to admit this freaks me out. Because when I'm approaching another car at 75 miles an hour, I'm wondering whether the computer's paying attention. And so I'm not quite there with trust yet. And I think probably a fully driverless car is going to freak me out even more if I'm still around. But that's about where we are right now with automated systems for mediation and other dispute resolution. They can do some things pretty well. They can sort. The algorithms can give you decision trees. Even some of the learning software can learn and give advice. And it's been e-commerce. It's becoming more and more common. And in fact, they really have to do that. The numbers are so staggering that they have to find a way to be able to do that. Eventually, we're going to get there. IBM's Watson and some of the others that are going to be overtaking Watson in the next few years are really going to make it possible to have self-learning systems. And so sooner or later, we're going to build a better mediator, right? So what does that mean for us, the people who are in this room? I think it actually means two things. One is not all problems are going to be appropriate for building a better mediator. Not all of them are going to be appropriate for fourth parties. So I don't think human beings, being as messy as we are ever going to be in a position where, in my lifetime certainly, and probably not in your lifetime, going to be in a position where we don't have mediators anymore, where we just have mediation programs. And in fact, I don't even think that is the goal of anybody who's working on this stuff now. What I do think it means is that it's likely to change the nature of cases that you get. You're likely to get messier, more fun cases, because in a lot of ways, some of the simpler stuff and some of the access to justice things that Jeff and I will talk about this afternoon are going to be handled in a very straightforward way by driverless mediation. The other thing that I think is really important that you all ought to be thinking about now is decisions about how to craft those systems are being made now. If mediators want to have their input in how this field is going to develop, you ought to be talking to the folks who are doing this development now. You know, ACR, ABA, the AAA, dispute resolution centers, and we ought to be engaging with the people who are interested in developing automated systems, because we can help guide them in what would be an effective automated system, because we know it best. So that's one thing. Second revolutionary thing, I think, is the use of big data. And big data gets tossed around a lot, but really all it means is data sets that are large enough that individual human beings simply cannot cope with what's there, simply cannot understand what's in the data sets and make sense of it. And we have big data solutions now that are to some degree being used in other fields, but not so much in mediation yet. In e-commerce, yes, but not so much in other parts of mediation. Where I think this is going to go is it's going to change practice remarkably for those people who do public policy interventions and who do multi-party interventions. And I'll give you an example of the horror story that can be assisted by this kind of revolution. Back in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s, the Department of Agriculture had an organic standard basically a rulemaking that they wanted to go through. And they had traditionally done comments on their rulemaking by getting people to send in mailed comments. You write it on a postcard, send it in. Or they had a telephone line, you could call it in. And this is about the time that email is becoming a really big thing. And so some bright guy in the Department of Agriculture said, gee, why don't we let people send us comments on email? And a week later, they had 1 million comments. And then they looked at each other and said, what do we do now? We got them, we have to read them. And they were still coming in. And they didn't really have any way to deal with that. And now we have ways to deal with that. We have all sorts of applications that are out there that will take massive amounts of input and draw conclusions about relationships among the comments. And so let me give you a concrete example that I think is coming in the very near future. If I'm doing public policy work and I have an entire community, let's take something that unfortunately has happened all too often. We have a questionable action by the police and there's a shooting. If I'm going in as a third party working with that community, it's very tempting to draw the interested parties in a fairly broad brush. I have the black community, the white community, the police, the politicians. You know, I can identify those interest groups fairly easily. But human beings are messier than that. So it's very likely that somebody who's in this group over here that I'm treating this way has an interest that is shared with somebody in a group over here. And that there's all sorts of interconnections there that go well below the surface. But if I'm getting thousands and thousands and thousands of comments in, which is not unusual, it's very difficult even for a good team of interveners to really figure out what's going on under the surface. If you have a big data program that can say, oh, by the way, you've got a significant number of people over here in this group who actually are pretty much aligned with on this issue with people who are over here in this group, that changes the way I approach my intervention because it gives me information I didn't have before. And we're close to that. We're very close to being able to use those things at the moment. Another revolution that's coming, and the front edge is already here, is a redefinition of what we mean by justice and the justice system. And Jeff and I will talk about this in some more detail this afternoon. But essentially what's happening is this. ADR and mediation has traditionally been an adjunct to the formal court system. So when we say access to justice, what we normally mean is access to the courts. Right? What's happening in many places, and in some pilot programs in the U.S., but mainly in Europe and other parts of the world, is there's an acknowledgement that that system is fatally broken, that it doesn't serve most people's interests. So you just look at the statistics in the U.S. Something like 70% of justiciable issues in the U.S. never go anywhere near the court system. And if you're poor in the United States, the courts are where things happen to you, not for you. And so you don't approach them. So there's a huge unserved mass of people who have problems who don't approach the justice system because it's too expensive or they don't understand it or some other reason. Well, what's happening, for example, in the UK, what's happening over there is there's a pilot program underway that says, look, we're going to turn the system upside down for a minute. We spend almost no money on prevention. We spend very little money on ADR and third-party work, the mediation before you get to court. But we spend almost all of our money on judges, courtrooms, and litigation. So what we want to do is we want to take a venue, in this case it's small claims, we want to turn it upside down. We want to put a bunch of money and a bunch of effort into ADR and prevention. We want to make it mandatory that you go into mediation before you can even approach the court. In other words, now what happens in this country is you file in the court, and a judge will say, okay, now that you filed in the court, go over to the mediator, and the mediator will help you try to work this out before you go to trial. There are some programs, there's a restorative justice program, some other stuff, where even then, even though it's a settled program, you still are an adjunct of the court, essentially. So what they're saying in the UK is remove that adjunct status. Make it the front door for everybody. And do it on mobile technology. So somebody who's a guy who's on the shop floor working and he has a break can take his mobile phone and ask a question in an ADR context, get an answer, and perhaps even hook up with a mediator who can help him with a problem and never have to approach the court system at all. And their assumption is, and we'll see how it plays out, is that if you do that, if you put a bunch of money and effort and mandatory use of ADR on the front end, what you'll find getting into litigation are those cases that actually ought to be there instead of the cases that are clogging the courts now. And so that's an experiment that is going to be repeated in many places. It's going to be repeated in this country. And it's driven by both mediation and the fact that you can use technology now to interact with and to access those systems in a way you never could before. So if I can build a system that allows me with mobile telephony to make the first contact, get referrals, and perhaps even wind up hooking up with a mediator, then that should explode our business, for one thing. But it also should mean that people are going to be served better. And so that's a revolution that's coming, I think, that's on the way here, and we're going to see it pretty soon. And I think it's a positive revolution. So even though we've been evolutionary so far, I think there's some revolutionary things that are coming. And again, it's not the group with the pitchforks. We're not out to destroy the system. What we're saying is, probably like a lot of you, the reason I got into this business in the first place is I actually care what happens to the people who come and work with me. And so if I can find a way to use technology to better deliver services, to make it easier for them to get information, to make it easier for them to deal with me, why wouldn't I do that? That's why I'm doing this work in the first place. And so I'm not scared by the technology. I'm also not married to it. And so what I do when I'm working with parties is the cutting edge question is, if I use a piece of technology, does it add value? If the answer is no, don't use it. If the answer is yes, why wouldn't I use it if it's going to add value to the parties? This is a social critic by the name of Kenneth Burke. He's unfortunately long since passed away, but he was a mentor of mine. And I was talking with him about method, how one does work. And we were sitting on a bar stool, or two bar stools, although he wasn't in my lap. Sitting on two bar stools, which is, of course, where a lot of good thinking goes on. And I said to him, so tell me about your method. What is the method that you use to understand what's happening when you do your social criticism? And he said, well, and he has written a bunch of stuff about method. And I expected a lecture on his favorite method, and I was really kind of looking forward to that. And what he said to me, it stuck with me, is maybe the best advice I ever got as a practitioner. He said, I don't have a method. I will use anything I can find from anywhere I can find it that will help me understand why people are behaving the way they're behaving in stressful situations. And so I don't care where it comes from. If it's useful to me and it will help me with my interaction with those people, I'll use it. And again, that's kind of the way I've always approached technology. If I can find a way to adapt it that adds value to me and the parties, I use it. If I can't find a way for added value, it's not there. So I don't find technology use in mediation strange at all. If you look at what we've done in mediation over the years, I've seen sessions on using Aikido as a mediation method. I've seen dance, I've seen theater, improvisation, mediation or meditation. My wife teaches yoga and Qigong and uses those in her mediation practice. So we use all sorts of stuff, and we don't freak out about that. But people tend to freak out when you talk about computers. And it's just another tool that you should adapt. And so if I don't find Aikido weird, why would I find joint text editing programs weird? You know, I'm looking for things to adapt into my practice. So what I see is the current state that we're in right now is that ADR, ODR, and ICT are in sort of an never-ending loop. That ODR and ADR are not separate, that online tools are part of mainstream practice, that developments in ICT will feed developments in ODR, which will feed developments in ADR, which will give us ideas about what to do with ICT and run us around the circle again. And that's where I think we are, and I'm perfectly comfortable with that. So evolution, not revolution. As far as I'm concerned, viva la revolution. So thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.